Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
Okay, you're welcome along. So we have a special rugby slot this evening. I'm very happy to say we've dragged in the big dogs. We have Brian O'Driscoll standing by. Hello.
Hi there, Joe.
And we have Ronan O'Gara from La Rochelle. Hello, Ronan.
Hi, Joe. Hi, Brian. We've
had a lovely sunny day here. How's the weather where you are, Ronan?
Turning. We had a desperate day yesterday and poor morning, but maybe it's just us, but the sun is emerging and the gloom is beginning to be left behind. So hopefully potential evening swim ahead, but maybe not.
Is that not Access Enter D, no?
Access Enter D, oui. Yeah, it is, but living on the beach, you can slip in and slip out and say nothing. But it's great. Great for the head.
All seven of you?
No. Honestly, you wouldn't be allowed. No chance. You'd be instant €135 fine or 200. And there's... I used to play rugby for Ireland. There's none of that.
Will you wear your La Rochelle gear down the beach?
Yeah, my black and yellow speedos. Some sight. With the two Spanish onions stuffed inside. Oh, my brother-in-law told me that one. It was brilliant. Sergeant Gary McPolin, thank you for that.
Oh, Gary.
Inspector, yeah, you know.
Long time since I've heard that name.
Long time since you're not there with him 15 years ago. Joe, we don't get out often, do we?
This is clearly the first adult conversation you've had in a few days. Brian,
yes,
how are you?
Exactly.
I'm good, Joe. I'm good, like, all things considered. Yeah, it's like, it makes it easier with a beautiful day out there. I don't have a huge back garden, but to be able to get out and just soak up a few rays of sunshine, you know, changes the mood a little bit. I've been pretty quiet the last while, but I've had a busy morning this morning. I had a couple of calls and things. So, it feels good to be busier. You know, feels as though you're adding value to the world, whereas sometimes when you're sitting on your hands and trying to pass time, it becomes a frustration. So I think that's why it's important to make sure that you kind of schedule out your day and you don't let it just whittle away, that you actually plan some things to achieve them and whatever that might be entail. Mm. So I made some brown bread yesterday and I'll make some scones later on in the week, so flat out here.
Where did it all go right, eh?
Brown bread's good, though. Brown bread's good. Geraldine O'Driscoll recipe, yeah.
And Phil Vickery has one or two ideas on that.
He's quite a chef, though. I think he's recently just opened his own restaurant that then obviously clearly had to close. But he might have won Celebrity MasterChef. He's a proper chef.
Oh, yeah, he seems to specialise in bread, I think. Yeah. Okay, so it's niche market, bread, sourdough. Well,
I haven't been so bold to go sourdough yet, but that's my next incursion next week.
Okay.
Brian, over the last couple of weeks, we have had Peter Stringer on with Ronan and David Humphreys on with Ronan, chatting about their, in the first case, relationship, and in the second case, I suppose, rivalry with them. So we might jump off on that point. There are other things I do want to talk to you about. What emerged in those two chats, and by Roger's own admission as well, is that he was a cranky so-and-so as a player. Was he cranky with you? Was he good to work alongside? I know you had a pretty good relationship with him. Your memory of him as a player?
He was cranky, I think. I think you want that, though, as well. You want a little bit of narkiness in your 10, demanding of one another, setting high standards. I started just, you know, Rog broke onto the Munster scene before I did with Leinster in Ireland. So he was there for maybe a season or certainly half a season. Then I got capped out of nowhere. So when he came into the international fold, he had a bit of credibility in the bank already with playing provincially. So I'd watch that. And I think, as a teammate, you look and you judge people from the demands they put on themselves and the demands they put on everybody else. And you could tell from the very off that he wanted to be a high achiever, that he wasn't happy with mediocrity. And I think he, you know, it was part of that group of players that came through into the international fold that changed the face of Irish rugby from the doldrums of the 90s into a far more positive place where the expectation was to win more than you lose. And we immediately struck up a good partnership. I think part of that comes from a respect for one another on what you are doing on the training park and then at the weekend in matches, but also the rapport that you strike up off the field and the laughs that you have and the chemistry that you might have as well. And so tying all of that together has a big outcome to your overall relationship. And I think that's why we got on, you know, so well, and that's why we continue to get on so well, because in some ways we're vastly different, but in many ways we're kind of kindred spirits too.
Ronan, on the field, did you see the game in a similar way? Was there a good chemistry from the off?
Yeah, there was. It was really good, really easy. It was unbelievable for me to have a 13 like that in terms of, you know, I think I've said it to you before, Joe, where I suppose our money ball became a skip one, which shouldn't be the case. But the way the game was back then, you know, I mean, obviously, if Brian was marked by one man, you were kind of rubbing your hands. If it was two men, not too bad. Three men, he could still probably find something. And our lines of running probably needed a bit of work to do. But that's when I think really around 2000 onwards, there was an emphasis on backline play and strike moves. And I can remember in our first game against Scotland on, it's actually the 19th of February 2000 against Scotland in Lansdowne Road, I think we'd played a practice, a move all week, kind of first time video analysis from my point of view, really, to see the power of it. Obviously, we constructed this is how Scotland will defend against us if we do it like this, and we pulled off a play, and Shane Horgan went straight up the middle of the pitch, and it was his first game as well, and I think he had passing options on both sides, but as happens in your first cap, he just saw a haze of black and just ran into the only Scottish defender. But that, it was just
was that a Hendo wing, Rog? Was that a Hendo wing?
Yeah, so that's, was it 10 to 12 back to 10 with 13 short?
No, 10 to 12.
Oh, no, sorry.
No, 10 to 12 back to 10 with 13 breaking wide and winger coming inside 13.
Yes. Yeah, with 15 and 14 wide. Yes. Or sorry, no, 11 going out the back, isn't it?
That was it.
Dennis was excellent at with his speed in attracting defenders. Yeah, sorry, so get back to the point. It was very easy for me, Joe, to strike up a relationship. I think, and something now that I always would refer to in my coaching career, I think there was great connections on that Irish team from 2000 on, and I think where I started off, I was lucky in the fact that Munster, we had Keith Wood that came back for maybe 1 year, I think, from Harlequins, and that was the 99-2000 season that I lost the final that season. But he really accelerated, I suppose, professionalism for a lot of us, because I think if you recall, that Harlequins team had a backer, and they basically, it was nearly like a World 15 at club level. And we had them in our group, I think, the previous year. And then Woody came and played with us, but he really brought things on. And I was lucky enough to kind of go as to the World, not to the World Cup, but as a kind of a training replacement to the World Cup training camps, and to see the best of the Irish stock. So it was, once you got in there, it was... when you had someone like Brian younger than you, but obviously better than you, it was still a huge comfort for me, because at 10, it's big ass mask, and you know what I mean, Claw, Golov, a lot of them were monster forwards, but you, essentially your role is to push them around the park.
Very quick tangent, that move you mentioned there from, what, 20 years ago now, is that obsolete, or is that something you as a coach now could spring and it would work very well?
Yeah, they're all coming back. It's amazing. Like the big thing about, you know, the Dan Carter line is the simple things done well over and over again. Never has it applied more, especially in the modern game. His capacity to say square at the line and deliver passes, I think, is what separates him. Mm. But the moves now are like, Brian will know more on this. The fact like that, the Leinster special play with Johnny to Darce or Contepomi to Darce to either Dricko on a hit line or out the back to the 10, it was done by the Brumbies, I would say, probably in the 80s, maybe. That try that Ireland conceded in the left-hand corner in Lansdowne Road in the World Cup against 91 against Australia, when Lina gets in. I think the start of that is the same framework as a Brumbies, or I don't know what Leinster used to call it, but it's a really hard move to defend if it's done well with multiple threats. I suppose that's the point I'm trying to make.
It's just on that play, it's so, you know, so funny listening to commentary sometimes. So, we see the Leinster wraparound play as well. It's not just a wraparound play. We got someone popping in, Rog. Say hi. But it's not just a wraparound play. The thing is, it's an undefendable play if you all run the right lines. And that's the thing. If people run lazy lines, you're dead, because then it's just laterally, you're going to be shipping the ball on to someone that's going to get annihilated.
Mm.
So
yes,
it's the selflessness of those that aren't going to get the ball is the difference between the success of a play and it falling flat on its face.
Right.
And they have to show the same deception. They have to show the same interest. If you start running and you don't have your hands up, you're not getting the ball. You got to run as though with intent, as if someone, you know, occasionally might throw you the pass just to keep you honest. Yeah. And that's what we used to talk about at training the whole time, is if you're not an option, if you drop a ball because you're not an option, well, it's going to be on you. That might be you in a game. So at all times, everyone always had to be an option. And if you're an option, then you're there to take it. And if someone, you know, be it Rog or Contepomi or Johnny, decided to throw that short pass to keep you honest, you better hold it.
And Brian Ronan mentioned there that on more than numerous occasions, you might have had two men keeping an eye on you, and maybe on a bad day, three men keeping an eye on you in your real pomp. So I suspect quite often you were just decoy, were you?
Yeah, there was a bit of that. I think you know, probably defenses were very different then as well. Very, very soft. And so, you know, we talk about that flat one or a Frano, as it was known. I don't know if I've ever said why it's known as a Frano. So I almost got nicknamed Frano after Neil Francis, because I was injured at training a couple of times in my first few outings with the Irish team. Eric Elwood was like, Frano is back. Here's Frano. Frano was always injured and then played all the games. And this was an appalling nickname to get hold of. So anyway, I managed to shake it, but we held on to the Frano, the flat one, as a name. I don't think they use it anymore. I'd be surprised if they do, but that used to be a go-to play of ours. But so defenses were vastly different. And you know, it's not like for like these days, but sometimes you'd get a little bit more attention. And then the knowledge is that, you knew somebody else had more space somewhere else, and that was your responsibility of trying to run the decoy line, but run it with the same intent as if you were going to get it, to stick those defenders and you know, create space for the Dennis Hickeys or Shane Horgans or Jordan Murphys or Irvin Dempseys. Actually, I was doing a little bit of homework today and looking back on the Ireland New Zealand game in Chicago, and it's the small things. I actually put a post up of it on my Instagram, of Simon Zeebo, of exactly what Rog was talking about, Dan Carter, of that taking the ball to the line, sticking the inside defender, having the second defender having a little look in, but then still throwing the pass. And it's the simplicity of catch pass. But if you don't take it with intent, where you look as though you're a threat yourself and you just ship it on or run across the field, the play is null and void.
Yeah.
Everybody has to show intent that they're potentially a ball carrier themselves. And the knock-on effect is it creates space in the wider channels, and that's what happened on this occasion. Ireland nearly scored a try from it, but it's you know, it's a vastly, vastly different game than the one in 2000 when Rog came onto the international scene, and it's kind of apples and pears.
Sure, no, I accept that. Ronan, you spoke a couple of weeks ago about when you were kicking and Paul O'Connell would make up your mind for you. He would point towards the post, not give you a chance for any doubt, for any discussion almost. And he wouldn't ask you how you were feeling. It was just point towards the post. Brian, obviously captain of Ireland for a very long time. How did he tend to work things when it came to you and your kicking? Were you told or were you asked sometimes?
No, it was brilliant, I think, in the fact that I suppose Brian is, perception sometimes isn't reality. And the fact that when it came to those decisions, there was a very serious side to him too. But I think it's about knowing your player inside out. And he knew exactly, I think, there's a huge, I think, understanding between the two of us. But also the fact that there came a time when he would just point. That was what was happening. And I think we played together an awful amount of time. Am I there?
You're back. Yeah.
Sorry. Excuse me. I don't know what happened. I think that was absolutely crucial in the makeup of our relationship, because I think in 2000, 3 points were probably different. And a lot of data has emerged, I suppose, in the last few years about a certain amount of points needed to beat certain amount of teams. But back then, there wasn't that data. It was a lot of times it was 3, 6, 9. And if you got a try, well and good. But the kicking game was hugely, hugely important. I'd say more out of hand, but also off the ground. But he knew me inside out. I think he knew the days I was probably low in confidence, and he knew the days that I was flying. And I think there was sometimes, I don't think it was Brian, some guy who kind of kept a close eye on my game, he just remembers me saying to him, don't start the game with a Hail Mary, because I sometimes had a habit of maybe first kick a goal attempting from 54 metres because you think you're brilliant, but that's not sometimes not the right thing. It's about building pressure, putting the ball into the 22, getting the forwards to roll them all, kind of sucking the life out of the opposition. I think there was a great, a fantastic relationship there between kicker and captain in terms of kicking that.
Yeah, almost an empathy. Brian, were you conscious of that? Were there certain days where you felt he mightn't have been kicking his absolute best and you might have steered it away from him?
I used pretty much a clutch kicker the whole time. Yes, like everybody's human and he had the occasional off day. But I think you get to know, the longer you play with someone, the more you get to know their range, how they're feeling, but also playing the sense of where the game is going and the momentum being built, whether it was vitally important to pick 3 points or whether you could go for the juggler a little bit more, where, a kick out maybe on the 5 or 10 meter line, a kick, 10 meters from touch out on the 40. Yeah, you might have a shot at goal and it would be hugely rewarding to get 3, but the thought about potentially missing that and taking the foot off the throat of the opposition, where you could, do that by kicking to the corner. I think you understand that as a player, but also a lot, sometimes I'd go up and Rog would make a decision himself and go, let's go to the corner, let's stay on this. And I'd be like, decision made. And that, I think the comfort in knowing when you're 10, who's very, very comfortable kicking goals, when he goes and says that, that there's no cop-out in that. He wants to get after this because I've seen him kick them a million times. So I think that gives you a comfort and a reassurance as a captain that you're like, right, there's 7 points on the line here as well, because we know he'll kick the conversion. So I think that comes with understanding how the individual ticks but also understanding the flow of a game as to how important 3 points is at any given time.
Sure. One last, it's a short question and it probably potentially has a very long answer. So, I understand that there's a nuanced answer and I'm going to ask for a more blunt kind of response. If you two look back in your Ireland careers, which were in tandem for a huge portion of them, and if you were having a quiet drink together or a quiet chat, Ronan, do you look back as a pair, do you suspect and think, we didn't do everything we wanted to achieve, but we were happy enough? Or is it maybe more towards the spectrum of regret, and there was more talent in the team and you could have done more. How do you almost categorize what you two did together in an Irish jersey?
Do you want to go, Brian?
Well, I don't know whether that was that to you, Raj, but I'll take it.
Okay,
I'll take it. A little bit of column A, a little column B, right? First of all, I think the timing of our, our being brought into the international squad initially for me first in 98 and then captain 99, Raj captain 2000. The team and the mentality of our squad at the time was otherworldly than where it is now. And I think sometimes people lose sight of that. So from where we went then in the doldrums of the 90s through to achieving a Grand Slam in 2009 and leaving definitely one more behind us in 07, I think, you take huge satisfaction that we were able to turn it around. That said, you look back on how you could have changed things and how you could have copped on a little bit earlier and how you could have been a little bit more professional, certainly from my point of view. And would that have given us a better opportunity of being more successful? Maybe. But it was of a very different time. We were still getting used to becoming professionals. We were playing with lots of guys that had been amateurs before, and their mentality was vastly different to those that have only ever been professionals. And I think that was a seminal moment, that when those players that had played amateur rugby then retired, I think the level of professionalism kicked on to a completely different level. And that's no slur on them. That's just a natural instinct that they tasted one type of international sport or provincial rugby. And then, they were being paid to do something similar. And it's a very different, difficult mentality switch to just, forget your previous life and treat yourself in a new one. So I think, when things did change a little bit for me, probably 05, 06, and still continue to make some errors, but I feel as though we did well, but we had more in us. And I still look back with satisfaction, one Grand Slam, one Six Nations, multiple triple crowns, and it's a reasonable outcome from 15 years, but it could have been better too.
Okay. Raj, how do you see it before we move on?
Yeah, I think the big thing that gnaws at me would be World Cups. I just think that really dissatisfies me, just the opportunity. And well, as Brian said, in 03, there was never any talk of going down there to win. That was the mentality. And probably with a little bit of hindsight, if we beat Australia in the final pool game, I think we play Scotland in that quarter final. So everything could have really changed then. 07, I wouldn't change anything about the preparation. Emptied the tank, gave it everything. I think everyone in the squad did.
You made the preparation from 07?
In terms of, individual preparation, in terms of what I gave to it, obviously in terms of getting the periodization of peaking, I don't have any answers for that. I just knew that time in Spala, when we went there for that training camp, as individuals, we were all in peak condition. But after that, I have lots of question marks in my head.
I wasn't in peak condition. Now, I think I dropped the ball. I had a big period of being away from the game, from the last Six Nations game, and there's a huge focus on being enormous, and boy, did I get enormous. I came back from my summer holidays over 100 kg, and I think that was a real error on my behalf. And I kind of played scared in the World Cup. I played okay, kind of individually. I had a couple of big moments and scored some important tries, but I think I look back on that with big regret that I didn't get my act together a lot earlier in the year and realize what an opportunity it was, because that was a Grand Slam we should have won in 07, and we had the capabilities of definitely getting to a semi-final that year. And alas, I think individually I got it wrong, but I think collectively we got the build-up to that completely wrong, where that huge focus of getting big and getting strong and being able to deal with the power of France and Argentina took over, and it changed our psyche, and we didn't become rugby players, we were weightlifters. And I think that's where we made a huge error. So I think it was a combination of my own mistakes that World Cup, but also as a collective that we didn't get our regime right and we didn't give ourselves a fighting chance to go into it.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah, mine would be different then in the fact that from that, getting my body right, I felt the body was right, but then when it came to rugby, because I think we cared so much about a performance, week one, we didn't perform, tried to push it harder Monday to Friday. I think come Saturday, for a number of weeks, we were empty on game day. There was nothing to find when the pressure came on, when we looked to find another gear, dead in our feet. I can remember, I think it's an image that will stay with all of us when we tried to, defend the Argentina 8-9-14. And we could never succeed in training. And then it kind of just, one of the first plays of the game, Argentina score off it. It was just like, oh my God, is this happening?
But did we, I think we left training not fully understanding what we needed to do, which is something you just can't afford to do. Whereas, you know, the second team ran in that 8-9-14. And they got us a couple of times. And it was almost like, it'll be okay, we'll be fine on the day itself. And then they scored immediately themselves in the quarterfinal. And you look back on that in particular and go, how did we not resolve it there and then? Because it felt as though we were still scratching our heads coming off that training park.
Yeah, I think there was. I think we probably maybe had the structure right, but the execution of defending it didn't go well. And then, as you said, doubt and fear came in, and when there was so many different opinions, but we didn't probably nail the solution there and then. But I think going back to Joe's point, I think the World Cups were the big disappointment for me. Other than that, I think the Six Nations were, like Brian said, we started off from a low base,
yeah,
and got there, and you're ploughing that furrow. And I think now that you're retired, It's the memories of the people you play with, as opposed to, I suppose, the medals. That's what keeps you humming.
Something else I wanted to get your thoughts on then. Stephen Kenny's taken over as Republic of Ireland manager with immediate effect. We all wish him well. And one of the things which has been said by numerous players this week, because the question has been posed, you know, this is his first time stepping up to this level, and some of the players won't be as familiar with them. And all of the players we've heard speaking this week have said, well, you know what, even if you're a big-time reputation, or even if you're not known from Adam, that first week, those first training sessions, that first meeting, you're almost on a kind of audition, and players very quickly make up their mind, and they can smell a fraud, and they can smell someone who really knows their stuff. So it really seems like first impressions are very important. Ronan, as you, the coach going in, what kind of impression did you try to make with the lads at La Rochelle? Do you give it the big time sell at the meeting? Do you go in quiet? Do you meet them individually? The first training session, what's your approach? Give us a sense of how you went with all that.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I probably, taking the soccer question you asked there, my gut reaction is kind of say, okay, so what happens Ireland when they win 5 out of 5? It seems a very short-term focus that a lot of the players are talking about. So for me, I think it comes back to, what kind of a legacy do you want to leave, or what's the higher purpose? Obviously, when you win silverware, where do you go to from there? So I think for the La Rochelle question, I got a taste of this with the Crusaders, which is brilliant. I think probably 4 months into my first season there, you get kind of analyzed and critiqued a lot to make you better. So I just kind of got pulled aside by Razor one day, and he just goes, stop trying to tell them or show them that you know everything. I said, I wouldn't have got you over here if I felt you didn't know your detail. You're too into detail. So just start connecting with them, and you don't have to show them that you know everything. But it takes a good coach to be able to say that to you, and I think it's very important that you hear that from the boss, because I think I even had a few chats offline with coaches I respect this week, and that was one of the key things, is you're trying to impress on your players sometimes that I know. You knowing isn't the key. It's how do you impart that information on the boys who are essentially not going to war for you, but going representing you this weekend. And I think that comes from a secure coach. I don't think Stephen Kenny in his first meeting is going to be going, I have to nail this to get these boys inside. I don't think that would be the mentality or the mindset at all involved, because you mean he's backing himself to be there for a good stint. So, you know, I think it's important that people know that medals are given out in the rugby calendar in the months of May. You start your season in August. So it's a very important to get the plan right. And sometimes you may have the plan right, but you don't get it in that sport. But that's why we all keep coming back for more.
Brian, did you make up your mind quickly, Brian, when a new coach arrived?
Pretty quickly, yeah. I think it's a more challenging situation that Stephen Kenny finds himself in, because reputation and respect does count for a lot, particularly when you come into a huge role like Irish head coach or Irish manager is. And, you know, there'll be some players that come into that environment that won't know a huge amount other than what he's achieved in League of Ireland, you know, underage. But he will probably have to prove himself a little bit more. And that does happen in the first few weeks of getting a credibility, getting players on side, saying the right thing, keeping people excited about the prospect of what's coming down the line. And from my point of view with new coaches, I suppose we had a similar situation with Michael Cheka. He'd come from Randwick, pretty much unknown, and we took a real chance on him. And he was in the fortunate position that we were in a bad spot. We'd gone through, he was our fourth coach in 4 years, and we were a bit of a shambles. So he came in at close to rock bottom of where we were as a side. And so he started saying some things that we could react to, and he started changing the mentality from day one and kind of deconstructing us to reconstruct. And I think that's exactly the sort of coach that we needed. But I must say, over the course of, he built that credibility. I remember him filling me with confidence about 6 months in. He said, what we're going to do is we're going to win the Magners League as it was in year two, and we're going to win Europe in year three. And he was adamant about this. And we managed to get to the semi-final of Europe out of nowhere and got beaten by a much better Munster team that year. But I think what that did was it realised that if we can get there on the basis of his quality coaching with a side that's a fraction of the potential that we could put together in another side, well, you know, we got a chance here. So I think the unknown coaches, the coaches that haven't been there and done it previously, they do have their work cut out, and they've got to start delivering pretty quickly, because players can smell bullshit. They can sniff it out pretty quickly, and that can fester, and that can, you can have, depending on the type of personnel within your squad, that can filter through it. And if you have that, it just, you know, the environment that you create and the culture that you create will give you absolute limitations to what you can achieve.
I'm sure, yeah, because players talk, you know. I mean, I'm sure it's happened at La Rochelle after the first few days. They're in the car together and they're like, what do you make of this O'Gara chap? So I wonder what they're saying.
Yeah, you kind of, that'll happen everywhere. I think it's fairly normal, I think. And how they see the game too. Players are very, and they have to be extremely selfish in how they see it, because they see it for as themselves. It takes a really skilled player, I think, to be able to see it from a different player's position point of view. So if you're looking to, I think an awful lot of players, probably once you kind of initiate change, they get a little bit frightened or spooked by that. But then it depends how it looks, and it depends how that kind of affects them, because it's very much the individual before the collective as a player's mentality, and you need that killer mindset in players, because that's what makes great players. So it's very normal, obviously, for you know, I mean, especially in rugby, it's very different in soccer, because it's probably, you know, you have defenders and attackers, but a forward mindset to a backs mindset is different, and is he more in favor of the backs, the forwards? But all these questions are very legitimate, Joe, and I think it's, you expect probably to have a certain people to be on board straight away, other people hesitant, other people not at all on board. And if you want to be a leader, I think your challenge is you'll have a core group, then you'll have a group that's wavering a bit, and you need to get you and the leaders to pull this group that's wavering a bit up towards the first group, and then you probably have a group of hopefully less than 10 that are not on board at all. And with that, hopefully you'll only have one or two rotten apples and not 6 or 8 or 10 of them. And that's the challenge in having of managing a group, because...
And sorry to interrupt. What do you do with that maybe 10 with the two rotten apples? Do you ignore them completely, or do you try and show them lots of love and affection? How do you handle that bunch?
That's what I'm trying to work out. it's difficult now, because it's you know, if they're under contract for another 2.5 years, it's a big check you have to write, and I don't think that's the policy, and I don't think Gareth Fitzgerald ever wrote a check to get rid. So it shows me, if you have the right environment, you can get bad eggs to become good eggs. And I think that's the challenge, because I don't think there's a bad person underneath it. Sometimes it might be a very frustrated player, but you got to hear these guys out, because there's always two sides to every story, and you might think that you're seeing it this way, but after a few in-depth chats, I think you can get these guys on side. But that's what connecting is about. The strategy is one side of it, and the technical tactical is another side, but connecting with people, I think if they want to play for their coach or don't want to play for their coach, it's very, very powerful, and it's very emotive as well.
I think you can have popular guys that are bad for your environment, where they're actually, you know, they're good fun people, but yet they don't have that winning mentality. They're just happy to be there. And we had that in Leinster in 06, well, all the way through the 2000s, where people were just happy to be professional rugby players rather than the mentality of wanting to win or needing to win, chasing silverware. And I think until you do sift those players out, you are only as strong as your weakest link, and particularly if they're going to be playing week in, week out. I remember something I've spoken about before. I don't know if I've said it on the show. I remember in 06, we were... it was December, and Dennis Hickey, I think it was, tore his hamstring or had a tweak of his hamstring out of training. And one of the lads, we came into the dressing room, and we were in sheds at the time. He came into the dressing room. He said, "You know, what happened to you?" And he said, "Oh, I have a tweak of my hamstring. Kind of feels grade one, grade two. It's going to be, has the feeling it's going to be a few weeks." Excuse my French here. And he says, "You lucky bollocks. How'd you manage to do that? You're going to be in out of the cold now for the next 3 weeks, and those dopes out there training." And it kind of brought a bit of a chuckle. But then the penny dropped as well. There was an element of seriousness to what he was saying, that he'd much rather not be out playing and training with everyone, where he just wanted to, you know, remain in his comfort zone. And for me, and he was a popular guy. And I remember thinking, we're in trouble here if we don't get rid of these sort of personnel or change that mentality. And it's no shock that, you know, it took us another 3 years to build that squad and get rid of some of those types of players with that type of mentality. And then all of a sudden we gave ourselves a fighting chance of being successful.
Yeah, doesn't quite sound like the Brad Thorne attitude your man had displayed there. Just a very quick last one then, before the clock really comes against us. Brian, as you listen to Ronan, I'm sure you chat to him occasionally offline as well. Is there any growing slight managerial itch that you want to scratch, or is there no chance now?
See, the thing about it is, and Roger's been brilliant with it, where he's travelled around and been happy to uproot his family, and there's more to it than, you know, than what you see here on online, or what you see when you watch, you know, games in top 14 or down in Crusaders. There's so much that your family has to sacrifice as well, and it's not just I was selfish for 15 years. It's tricky to continue being, you know, selfish that way. And some, you know, Jess, I know Roger's wife, has been absolutely incredible in being a support source to move around the world with him and his five kids. So I think that's that's phenomenal. You see the strength of the unit there. I don't know if I could, you know, comfortably do that myself with my circumstances, that I have a wife that's very career orientated. We've got a good setup here at the moment at home. I enjoy the variety to what I do. I get a little bit of the coaching aspect on TV of talking people through what I see, albeit you're talking to the masses rather than specifically upskilling, you know, individuals. So at the moment, no, but the longer I leave, you know, I leave it, the less likely it's going to be, because I'm already getting disconnected from the game. Some of the things that Raj talks about and some of the things that the current players talk about, it's hard to stay up to speed with what is relevant in the game, what's in vogue, because you need to be there on a daily basis or on a weekly basis. I can still understand the general picture, but...
I think that's overestimated, though, genuinely. I think the era, I think, the massive, I think, advantage of guys from our era, I think that for the amateur going into the professionalism, and you full-on professionalism like myself and yourself, I think there's a serious appreciation for game management. I think it's a topic that's going to come back more and more into the game. And I think the one example from doing a little bit of work was perception versus reality, maybe Munster to lose in that semi-final in 2000. You know, traditionally we were known as a probably 1-10 team and kicking the letter off the ball. But like the rugby back then was kind of in the try, I think Dominic Crotty set up for me.
Is that the John O'Neill no try?
No. This was, remember, in the piping hot day.
Oh, yeah. You had a big mushroom on that day. Remember it. big sweaty head on you with a big mushroom.
It was 30-odd degrees. Get back to task, Brian. I think that we had five offloads or something, playing the ball out of the tackle, and I ended up going under the post untouched. But just the variety to that game, but also the fact that I think you can see with England now where the game is going in terms of territory is coming back into the game and putting the hell of a line speed in the opposition's half, putting pressure on them, forcing the error, multiple kicking threats, but also, you know, I think possession sometimes isn't as important as people are making it out. And I think game management, in terms of someone like you with the brain you have, I don't think you're going to lose that aspect of rugby at all. I think that's completely, you know what I mean, players that don't play or aren't involved in coaching, they're going to lose focus or the new nuances coming into the game. I don't think that's true. Genuinely, I think it's important because for people that watch rugby, you can see exactly what's going. The problem for people like me and other guys is that you're influenced so much by your environment, and if you're stuck in that bubble all the time, you actually begin to think like everyone else inside in the building. Sometimes the best thing about this period, you remove yourself, you can think freely, normally, and it's the same thing when we were in Carton House with Camp Ireland. You know, you kind of go and go, well, as long as my coach is back me and support me, but like the public aren't silly either. Mm-hmm. They can see exactly what's going on, and Joe's very good at throwing a few grenades to me live in studio.
No, I'm not. Although listening to you now, it sounds like Brian O'Driscoll's coming in as your number two when you get the Ireland job in a few years. That's the interesting news.
No, one thing I do know that I can see, and it happens in commentary, is that I know that I can see the game a fraction before others still. And it happens with your lead comms, where it's not my responsibility to call the game, but I can see something unfolding before he sees it.
Sure.
Clearly all of them, and they're quite knowledgeable, but yet I can see it happening, and I know it's not saying half a second ahead, or even, you know, it might be a quarter of a second ahead, but I can tell with the shape of how something is forming, of whether a penalty is going to be for or against the attacking team and so on. And so it's tricky sometimes not to find yourself commenting on that or trying to call in advance and show your knowledge where it's not your place.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Because you probably just in terms of that, I think there's a great example there of an instinctive rugby player, but also a guy that probably played excellent rugby under a framework. But for 10 years, he was instinctive. Then he kind of had, I suppose, the Joe Schmidt philosophy, which was so much of it was planned and prepared during the week. So, you know, if you're a coach or a lover of rugby at the minute, kind of, you know what I mean, if you split the pitch into three thirds, so you've kind of the front five, middle five and back five, if you want someone to know exactly what to do when the ball goes to the 13, 15, 11, 14 channel, you're looking at them right here. And I think it's sometimes where people nowadays are saying there's not space, it's very hard to find space. I don't agree with that. There always is space. There's more space now because you have 13 in the front line. But who's looking for that space? That guy was phenomenally good at that. But as you say, it's how can you communicate that in a split second? But what cues are you looking for it? So it makes for an interesting discussion for part two, Joe.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. I hate to draw this to a close, but I definitely have to. So literally two last questions and you can give me quick answers. Ronan, for you, I asked Brian, was he getting any managerial itch to scratch? What about you, regardless of how it goes? Say it all goes wonderfully and you progress through and do every job you ever want to do, or say there's ups and downs. Regardless, would you like to still be coaching one way or another at the professional level into your 50s, dare I say it, even into your 60s? Are you now coach for as long as you can do it? Do you love it?
Yeah, I do love it, but it's challenging. And I've kind of made that decision, and hopefully I've 7 hard years done, 7 enjoyable years. But as Brian said, there was a lot to go with those decisions. But thankfully, I kind of had Jess who was willing to go. But like, because if she balked at even the start of going to Paris to coach at Racing, it would have stopped there and then. If you want to go to Crusaders, which I needed to do, because that's essentially probably the testing ground that you need to test yourself in. And I think that accelerated lots of things nicely, and it gave me a lot of confidence, and it gave me a lot of belief into what actually a great environment looks like. So it'll always be a reference board for me. I met great coaches, I've met great people, but great administrators, but great people who actually, when you say, you know, Robbie Deans, for example, just hangs around the coffee shop outside there. There's a number of coaches that just go up to Rugby Park and they hang around and they drink coffee and they just chat rugby because they love chatting rugby. I think that's why we got into rugby as young fellas, because we loved it and we played them and it was a game we enjoyed. But it's great to see guys 50, 60 years of age that go to a coffee shop just to discuss rugby. And then after that, I've come to kind of La Rochelle because it seemed like a big challenge. I suppose the move I could have done would probably be back to Racing and pick up a, you know, an assistant head coach role or something like that. But I felt like that I needed to have a go. What did he say?
A monster wage.
If I was a monster wage, I'd be doing what you're doing. So, you know, it's only 6 months into it, but in terms of this 6 months, the break we've got, I must say, it just came at the right time because I was run down, Joe.
Yeah, no, I've no doubt. Right, very lastly, because I'd be in trouble if I didn't get your thoughts on this, Brian, before we then definitely go. The short version, and everyone's following the main news, I suspect, rather than the sports news a lot at the moment. But if you haven't heard, Bernard Laporte, president of the French Federation, he wants to be World Rugby Vice President. That election is on in May. He wants to replace Augustin Pichot and be Vice President to Bill Beaumont. So, in short, he's come up with this proposal. He wants to end the Heineken Champions Cup, scrap it, gone. His reasoning is it doesn't bring enough money, so it would be the end of European rugby as we know it. And he proposes a Club World Cup every year. 20 teams, you'd have 4 from the Pro 14, you'd have 6 from Super Rugby, you'd have English, French teams, the US champions and the Japanese champions. And it would happen over 6 weeks. And this is what he thinks. This is the way he thinks we should go. The EPCR have come out, not surprisingly, a bit peeved and said, well, hang on here. And they've said, we're working at the moment on having a World Cup for clubs every 4 years. Who knows how it all plays out? I'm sure there's power broking and politicking going on here like I wouldn't believe. But what's very clear is, Brian, rugby as we know it is over. and in 5 years' time, we've got something very new. Would you hazard a guess as to where we're going most likely? Is this plan for real? Give us a final answer on what's going to happen here, and even in the medium term.
Talk about political brokering. Well, there's no better Buchel than Bernard Laporte. You know, he's a master of it, obviously, ex-French sports minister. You know, he understands how to play both sides. And if he's looking for that vice president, vice chair position, World Rugby, which by the sounds of things, the Chinese whispers that he's going to get if Bill Beaumont gets the main job again, the obvious thing in 4 years' time, well, he will be chair himself. He's got obviously aspirations for changing the game, but I do think there's a lot of jostling, a lot of stories being dropped in. It's hard to know, you know, which are truths and untruths. I've heard a multitude of different things that haven't even made the papers. I did hear that the EPCR are interested in modifying the competition. But as two huge advocates of European competition, it would be a huge shame. And I don't speak for Rog here, but I think it would be a huge shame to lose what has been an incredible competition over the course of the last 25 seasons. It's brought us so much joy, a lot of pain in the early years, but so much joy laterally, that surely there's a way to be able to keep it on, but yet incorporate this potential World Club Championship. And there's so much we could talk about around this, like player welfare alone. You know, we're talking about trying to reduce the amount of air miles in players and how much travel's involved. And then all of a sudden, Bernard Laporte is throwing in this grenade talking about playing club rugby at different parts of the world. So I don't know how much thought has properly gone into it. It's the first that we've really heard of it. So we're still digesting all that information. Maybe there is something in once in the 4 year cycle, outside of World Cup and Lions years where you do play that. And I think that would heighten the expectation, anticipation for who's the best club in the world in a 4 year cycle. But to be careful too, not to saturate the market as well of giving everybody what they want. You have to take hold a little bit back, and whet the appetite and build, build the game in doing so. There's no doubt we are coming into a very new landscape in rugby. There's talk of some clubs in the UK, you know, being in a little bit of trouble. You talk about unions with Australia, New Zealand, huge losses. Even England suffering 50 million with the potential of 30 more in November. The IRFU beginning to run out of runway. So, you know, if we don't get back playing soon, the landscape's going to be vastly different. So I think there's a huge amount more to play out besides the politics. We just need to get rugby back and playing and see where we're at that stage, because the uncertainty at the moment will continue until we get back into doing what we love and watching what we love. So it's a lot of it is really only hearsay for now.
Yeah, it's true. I think normal life resuming would be good on every front, wouldn't it? Fellas, we're pretty much out of time. Our rugby coverage was with thanks to Vodafone, hashtag team of us, everyone in. That was fascinating. It was great stuff. Ronan in La Rochelle, thanks very much. And thanks to your technical assistant there as well, who kept you going.
I took his bureau, as he calls it. We've only one office in the house and it's only Wi-Fi. My apologies. They're online school at 3 o'clock over here. So.
Oh, very good. Okay.
Daddy took his desk. Sorry.
Well, that's okay.
My technicians are still out in the hall, so I better go and relieve them.
Yes. Thanks to you both, Ronan. Thank you. Brian, much obliged. Thanks for the extra time. Appreciate it, fellas.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.